بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. This is a covering, almost a wrap-up of our last six lectures about the guided caliphs. And I think having narrated their stories sometimes a little bit analytically, I would like us to go back, to look back at the previous six lectures and perhaps try and derive some lessons from them. To start with, we should realize that they were people, ordinary people, not chosen by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, not prophets, not sacred people. And they had all the elements of a human being, with all the inclinations, with all the points of excellence, as well as the shortcomings, etc., etc. I say this because it's my experience when you mingle with devout Muslims that you are in no position to try and criticize any one of the guided caliphs or the Sahaba at large. Oh, these are Sahaba, no word, no discussion, no analysis, etc. And I think if we follow this, we will not be able to derive any lessons from this early Islamic history. So, with all due respect and love to them, I do believe that we should work our minds and have the courage to analyze and extrapolate, or else Muslims would be very prone to repeat the same mistakes, and this indeed happened, all because since the early times it was taboo to try and understand or compare or comprehend or criticize what the Sahaba did. Also, perhaps the series could throw a light upon the nature of the Islamic government. Everybody now says Islam is the solution, we want the Islamic government, etc. Sometimes with quite a bit of confusion. A couple of weeks ago, an Islamic government started, hallelujah, Islam has come, beginning the Islamic reign by closing the girls' school and locking women at home and forcing men to grow a beard, etc., etc. I do believe that the very earliest period of Islam can give us some clues upon the principal features of an Islamic government. After the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam died, he did not leave a fixed system which to follow in appointing the new head of state. The Prophet might have given hints, but he stopped short of saying, after I die, this man will be caliph. No, he didn't do that. And as you know, there was the meeting in the Saqifah, and the Ansar felt very strongly that one of them should be the new caliph, and then Abu Bakr and Omar went and debated, and Ali was in the Prophet's home seeing about the funeral and the burial, etc., etc., and it came up that Abu Bakr became caliph after that debate, and after a period of maybe pondering, maybe hesitancy, Ali gave his allegiance and things went on nicely. Upon the death of Abu Bakr, he invented a new form of recommending a caliph, and he said, I recommend Omar for you, and the people who were there will say, you recommend Omar, we accept Omar, etc. When Omar was about to die, he introduced yet a third method by which to choose the caliph. He named six people from the topmost ranks among the Muslims and asked them from amongst them to choose a caliph, and they chose Uthman. when Othman died, there was an unprecedented situation in Islamic history, that is, the chaos and the rebel and revolution, etc. And Ali was chosen yet by another method. So we should know that there is no fixed rule in Islamic Sharia that identifies explicitly how the head of state should be chosen, which gives us leeway in our present times to concoct whatever seems suitable and appropriate in our time about the choice of the head of state and the shape of the government. But the shura was always a conspicuous element, and therefore the government should be based on shura, that is, the workings of the government would be upon the shura basis. To me, shura looks like the forerunner of what we now call democracy. Everything is decided by shura, even to the details. The baby at home has to be weaned only after shura between its father and its mother, that he would be weaned. And of course, one of the essentials was the bay'ah, that people would give the pledge. The Prophet ﷺ said, whoever rules a people and they are hating to him, then it is a matter of jahiliyyah, and he will be punished in hell. And so the bay'ah of the people, that is, giving the consent of the nation for him to rule them. And this bay'ah was very consistent for Abu Bakr, who went out to ask the people, do you really agree upon me? And for Umar, and for Uthman, and for Ali. The essence of the pledge of the nation is an essential one in the choice of government. And in modern times we say that the nation, the peoples, are the source of authority, not the ruler, and that whoever gives the pledge is in a position to retract it, to withdraw it. And Abu Bakr made it very clear that the bay'ah, the pledge, is conditioned. He said, you obey me as long as you obey God, and if I deviate, then you owe me no obedience. All this sounds very familiar when we talk about modern-day democracy, really, that the government is by the people, for the people, as they say in modern United States. One of the basic features of an Islamic government is the freedom of choice of speech and criticism. And Islam goes a step further. It doesn't make it only a right, it makes it a duty. That I speak my opinion, that I criticize what I don't agree with, is now a right. And Islam doesn't call it only a right, but it calls it a duty. So that the Prophet ﷺ said, whoever is silent about a situation that touches the truth is a dumb devil. So if he sees something wrong, until I go and speak up, I would be like a dumb devil. And therefore it is the right and indeed the duty of the Muslims to feel free to speak and to criticize. And in an Islamic government, the caliph is not the master of the nation, as regrettably was introduced in that early period of Islam. The caliph, the ruler, is an employee, just like any other employee, who wouldn't even take the largest salary amongst the people. The ruler is a servant, not a master. And when Abu Bakr tried to manage his own affairs to gain his daily bread, they told him, no, we want to employ you full time, we'll give you a salary, not the lowest, not the highest. What is enough for you to live a decent living. Of course, this changed a long time ago amongst Muslims, although it is current and usual and the norm in modern societies. In an Islamic government, it is all right to quote from the others. It is not taboo, it is not haram to say, oh, this is what the kafirs do, are not going to do. No. Whatever is best for the people should be done, even if it belongs to other people. And we know that the full infrastructure of the Islamic State since the time of Omar was a quotation from he saw being applied in the Persian Empire and in the Roman Empire. And so he was the first to form an infrastructure, and even it left it for a good time, manned by the original people who are not even Muslims. And so we should feel free to quote, to modify, to adjust, to reject, to accept whatever is good for the people, whatever its source is. Then the Muslim state and the Muslim Ummah and Muslim government is a pluralistic society. We all now are in favor of pluralism, and in order to ensure equality and equity in our pluralism in the United States, we have coined a decree that religion is separate from the state, because if you mix them, maybe the some religious communities do not recognize the others, and therefore some people might be oppressed. This attitude of pluralism is an inbuilt mechanism in the Islamic Sharia. If you leave it and mix religion with the state, say in the United States, maybe the Protestants will suppress the Catholics. And it could have happened, and it is not new to the society. The Christians might oppress the Jews, for example, or the Muslims. And that is why in modern America we say separate the state from the religion. In the Islamic government, there is no need to do that, because already pluralism is a built-in mechanism within the Muslim Sharia. So that by juridical definition, a Muslim society is not a society of Muslims. According to the Sharia, a Muslim society is a society of Muslims, Christians, Jews, and others, the people of the book, and the other people who are not even the people of the book. They used to call them al-musta'manun, those who are given safe permit to live and enjoy the life in the Islamic society. And one of the earliest political feats of the Muslim era was the Treaty of Medina, when the Prophet made the treaty amongst all the tribes in Medina and the Jews as equals, as having the same rights and religious rights, etc., and the same duties towards defending Medina. Next point is that some people accuse Islam of having spread at the edge of the sword. This accusation took on for centuries, really. It is only in modern times that whoever tells me that, as I go in my lectures in churches and universities, I can point out names and numbers of present-day Americans who converted to Islam, and I ask, who put the sword to their necks in order to embrace Islam? So even in America, people are taking up Islam out of their own will. They are even taking it up against the gradient, because this is the first world, Muslims are the third world, and yet there are people in the first world who go and adopt the religion of those in the third world. Of course, Islam never spread at the edge of the sword. Political Islam started with being confronted with aggression from the Roman Empire and the Persian Empire, and it had to fight back. And the result of the fighting was almost miraculous, because a very small number of people with very modest arms could really defeat the two major powers, the Soviet Union and the America of that time. And the borders were always fluid. They fight back, we fight back and repel them for a distance. They fight back, we fight and repel them for a distance. Excuse me. So that within less than 100 years, political Islam spread its wings over more of the half of the known world at the time. But never was anyone forced to become a Muslim. And so Islam, the religion, was never the result of coercion. If Islam had that view, like what happened in Spain when Ferdinand and Isabella defeated the Muslims, or what happened in South America when the conquistadori came, etc., we wouldn't have had the problem of ethnic cleansing now. Muslims could have cleared it and made all people Muslim, but this did not happen. And the people were given the freedom to choose their religion upon the Quranic saying there is no compulsion in religion, and nobody would be persecuted because of their religion. Now there is some other argument that would say, oh yes, you gave the people the freedom to choose their own religion. But mind you, when you went to places like Palestine, like Egypt, etc., there was the jizya. You took money from the people, there was a tax on the people, and this is a kind of pressure over the people to become a Muslim. This is a very incomplete argument, because the jizya was, as a matter of fact, in lieu of exemption from military service. Don't get a Christian Egyptian farmer and compel him to be recruited in an army of Islam that he doesn't believe in. So it was a win-win situation. You stay in your land, cultivate it, enjoy it. We fight to protect you. And because you are exempted, pay us a little tax that was called the jizya. And the jizya was only for that, because when the army of Abu Ubaidah was in Syria, and the plan was to retreat, to leave the town and retreat to other lines, they gave the people the jizya back, because there are no more fighting there. And moreover, when a Christian chose to become a Muslim, it was not under financial pressure, because if you become a Muslim, now you are subject to a larger tax, which is the zakat tax. And quite often, it would have been financially better for people to remain Christian and pay the jizya than to become Muslim and pay the zakat. But lots of people converted to Islam even in spite of that. One novelty in the Muslim Empire, something that unfortunately didn't endure that much, is the status of woman in a typical Islamic state. You know that for the first time women had the right of being equals. The Prophet said the women are siblings of men. They had the same rights, the same duties, the same activities even. Of course, centering at that thing that only women can do and men cannot, and that is getting pregnant and giving children. But this was only the center of the circle, but the circle was very expansive to the extent that women taught that in the time of Omar, he appointed a woman judge. Heresy, if you say it now, say in Pakistan or in Egypt or in Mecca, etc. Come, woman, this is kufr. But that is what Omar did. He appointed a woman judge for commercial law. Woman was a teacher. Imam Shafi'i would say, I am proud to be the student of Sayyidina Nafisa. Women went to battle and did the nursing jobs, and they even took up sword and shield and joined active combat to be later praised by the Prophet. And so this fear and the role and the status of woman, of course, the right of inheritance, the right of accepting a proposal or refusing it, or even proposing herself, the right of individual unhampered ownership. You go to the bank and the bank wouldn't tell her, as what happens now, we need your husband's signature. No, if she owns something, she owns it. Father, brother, son, husband have nothing to do with it. There is one ambiguity that when inheritance was divided, a brother would take double the sister. But the division of the legacy, the division of the inheritance in that way, is based on the division of duties. Because woman will never be responsible for financially for the man, even if he becomes poor and if she's rich. But man is always legally, financially responsible for the woman, be she his wife, or mother, or sister, or aunts, etc. And because that's nice. I'm getting old, that's why. And because his financial responsibilities are far more than double her responsibilities, she is responsible for herself only. And that is why the logic says, because you have added responsibilities, it is only fair that you take a larger share from the inheritance. Unfortunately, that bright vision of women's emancipation of equality between the sexes, etc., didn't live long. Because it was only after a very short period that people reverted again to the era of authoritarianism, dictatorship, and they reverted back to their pre-Islamic habits, etc. And it lives with us until today, and in some societies it takes even an extreme form. But Islam declares men and women as equal. The question of Islam and democracy. Had it not been for that regrettable conflict between Ali and Muawiyah, if the Islamic procession took its way and ran smoothly and progressively, I am positive that the Muslims would have formulated something very similar to a modern Western democracy. Except for one radical difference, and it is really the difference. Whereas in a modern Western democracy like ours in the United States, God can be vetoed or outvoted if you have enough votes. And this is the snag about Western democracy. On the other hand, in an Islamic democracy, the constitution is based upon the Quran and the Sunnah, and whatever you legislate in conflict with them would be automatically unconstitutional. But the workings of government seem to be very democratic. Of course, I wouldn't describe Islam as a democratic religion, because Islam is 14 years older than democracy. But the runnings in a democracy, if only they would abide by the Quran and Sunnah, then it will be an Islamic democracy. Sometimes people are allergic to the word democracy. You meet Muslims, even the United States, and you mention the word democracy, kufr, 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 let alone in other Islamic places. And they are very prompt and very swift at criticizing democracy. And no one of them ever speaks about dictatorship. The ulama in Saudi Arabia would condemn democracy, but none of them would dare speak about dictatorship or human rights or freedoms or the accountability of the ruler before the nation or the supervision of the nation over the ruler. They would never mention anything of that. Although if you analyze Islamic history, you will find that the illness that afflicted us was never democracy. It was always dictatorship and authoritarianism. And we have been in this cage for so many centuries, like a bird in its cage. Even if you open the door for it, it will find it very difficult to fly. It has been bred generation after generation after generation in the cage, and its horizons are the bars of the cage, cannot fly. And if we need an Islamic reformation or revival, it would be something that would dissolve and absolve us of this complex of dictatorship. Someone has to do the thinking and may take the decision, and we are only to obey. This is not the nature of the Islamic State. This is not the nature of the Muslims in the time of the Prophet and Abu Bakr and Umar. Indeed, they would go to the Prophet and ask him, is this revelation or your own opinion? And when he says, this is my own opinion, they would say, no, we think it's wrong, you better do that. And he say, yes, okay, sounds reasonable. Omar would be making a speech and the woman said, oh, Omar, you are not in a position to say that. The Quran says this. What is the response? Not arrest, not imprisonment, not torture, not an accusation of trying to demolish the basis of the state. No. The woman is right and I am wrong. And that was the golden age that should really be our standard. Not what happened later on. What happened later on was human weakness and shortcomings, and Islam is not to blame for it. Islam, of course, laid down the principle immediately after the time of the Prophet of independent judiciary system. In his time, the Prophet was the head of state. He was the Secretary of State, he was the commander-in-chief of the army, he was the judge, he was the teacher, etc. But once the Prophet died, prophethood went one way, never to come again, and to be head of state came with Abu Bakr. And since that time, a judge would be appointed, and quite often the caliph himself would be summoned by the judge if somebody else filed a complaint against the caliph, and the judge will bring them to sit before him, and he would listen to the arguments and would pass the verdict even against the head of the state. So one feature is the independence of the judiciary. The other is the heeding of due process. When Omar went and found the people drinking, but he had to look upon them getting a stone, standing over it and looking down from the fence, and found them drinking, and he could do nothing. They said, your proof is not a valid proof because you didn't follow the due process. Allah says, you go to the houses from their doors and you are coming from the fence. And Allah says, don't spy on one another and you are spying on us. And the case was dismissed. So the concept of the acceptable proof was established since those very early days of Islam. Another principle was that the judge will not rule upon what he knows. If I saw you put your hand in his pocket and take his money, and I am the judge, all I would say, what is your complaint, what is your answer, is there any proof? Even if I saw it, I wouldn't pass the verdict upon my own information. And if I really want to help the justice, I would decline from seeing the case. Another judge would be appointed, and I go as a witness, not as a judge. There is also the establishment of the concept that there is a difference between a sin and a crime. A sin is to do something that Allah prohibited, and it is between you and Allah to punish you here or in the hereafter or both, or to forgive you. A crime is something for the judge. A crime is a function in the domain of the law, and you can do so many sins without committing a crime. You can take a woman and behind closed doors commit adultery with her. This would be a very grave sin. You cannot escape the watching eye of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. As the Quran says, chastisement will be doubled in the day of judgment, etc. But it is not a legal crime, because the domain of the law gives legal specifications. Unless they are fulfilled, then the case is dismissed as a crime. For example, the four people who went to Umar to report a case of adultery, and they all confirmed what they saw and identified the man, and the three identified the woman but not the fourth. Case dismissed, and each to be given 80 lashes for tarnishing the reputation of a Muslim. The due process, the legal specifications, it is not what you know. All other crimes, two witnesses are enough, but this is it. The Islamic law requires that for the crime of zina to be established, there should be four witnesses with a complete witness that they share exclusively. The consequences of the schism in the Khilafah, as we know, the days of Abu Bakr were very nice Islamic days, the days of Umar were very nice Islamic days, and then came Osman. And he came at the time when the two components of the empire were irreconcilable. Would it be a kingdom? Would it remain a caliphate? And with Uthman radiallahu anhu, having always been a rich man, having always been a generous man, his key was give, 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 give. But he gave more to his own tribe, and that was his response to the criticism that was accorded him by people who are still living in the caliphate and in austerity. Don't let the pleasures of the world take us or mystify our eyes. We are living for the hereafter. We are living with our limited means, etc., etc. And so it seems like that Osman didn't have the iron fist of Umar to keep the two components together, and to retain the Sahaba in the Medina, not to go abroad and build the palaces and be centers of power, etc., etc. And this ended, as you know, with the very sad event in Islamic history of a rebellion and the revolution and some people killing the caliph. This is really the saddest part of Islamic history. And then Ali became caliph, and then Ali was also assassinated, as we know. And what followed was that part of the nation took the role of the protagonists of Ali. Even if all the rest of the nation had to give their allegiance to Muawiyah and he became caliph, including even the son of Ali himself, Al-Hasan, who gave the pledge to make peace and stop bloodshed. Of course, as we said before, on the understanding that after Muawiyah he would be the next caliph, etc. But it was that period that gave rise to the separation of Shiism as a special group in Islam. The Shia, who couldn't swallow that Muawiyah becomes the caliph, sharing the same views as the rest of the nation, but taking the further step of declaring a revolution. We are not accepting this, we will fight for it. And since that time, they were the targets of severe repression and oppression by the government. Imagine that one of the first things Muawiyah did when he became caliph is to order the Friday speakers in the mosque to make it an integral part of the khutbah to curse Ali and Ibn Abi Talib and his family. And this went on for years and years, until one of the Umayyads by the name of Umar ibn Abdul Aziz was quite a good man, and he became caliph, and he was very good, and he ordered this stopped. And he tried to do very good things to the Muslims, but regrettably he died after 2 years and 3 months of his caliphate. As a matter of fact, he is used to be called the fifth of the guided caliphs. The Shi'is separated and find that their cause were not just the political one. Of course, it was a political thing, because who should have been head of state? It expanded. Who should have been head of state, not only after Uthman, but even directly of the Prophet himself? Ali should have been. And then later on, because it was the matter of justice and injustice, of course in Islam it becomes a religious thing, because the nation are enjoined to enjoin good and forbid evil, and so on and so forth, that this became a schism, and with a sad history between the Shias on the one hand and the non-Shias on the other hand. I refrain from dividing Muslims into Shias and the Sunnis. This is not true, because the Shias are also Sunnis. The Shias are people who believe that Muhammad was the messenger of God, and that it is their duty to follow him and to comply to his instructions and teachings. But it is the trap, it is a historical trap, that when Shiism separated, a new name was coined, called the Sunnis, and those became the Shias, and those became the Sunnis. Therefore, those are the people who follow the Prophet, but the Shia are not. A long history, and as usual, and as common, with Muslims under after they lived under the tight lid of dictatorship, to add folklore. And there was enmity quite often between the Shias and the non-Shias. And I dare say it lives until today. And one of the primary targets of Islamic workers today is to try to rid the nation from the cage of the past. If you live in the past and are imprisoned in it, you will never build a future. And now it is time perhaps to say, I'm not trying to make you a non-Shia. Don't try to make me a Shia. We are both Muslims. We are both facing enemies who are very strong, very crafty, very intelligent, very able, very capable, who are targeting Islam irrespective of Shia or non-Shia. And what is the conflict about? Who should have been caliph after the Prophet, after Uthman, which is really a matter of the past. It is not valid nowadays. Abu Bakr is gone, Ali is gone, Omar is gone, Uthman is gone, the Prophet is gone. But Islam remains. And as long as the battle for Islam is a battle between Shias and non-Shias, then Islam stands a very poor chance against its enemies. So it is now, as a matter of fact, a religious duty to try and build the bridges. You stay as you are, I stay as you are, he stays as he is, but we are Muslims. And we share Islam. And we share the responsibilities for Islam, and we share the duty to defend Islam in its present-day crisis. One of the worst crises Islam has ever met is these modern days, when the plan is to eradicate Islam from the face of the earth. You go and read the Gospel and the Quran, that is the minutes of a missionary conference that was held in Denver, Colorado in 1979. I read it. And it is the plan of evangelizing the Muslim world. Now the battle is not the religious-less people in Africa. Now the target is Muslims. I want them to become Christians. And they devised a scale which is called the angel scale. That there is a Muslim here, and let us label him zero. If he is more Muslim, would be plus one, and the plus two, and the plus three, and plus four until plus seven. But when he becomes less of a Muslim, it would be minus one, minus two, minus three, minus four, minus five, six, minus seven. At the minus seven, he becomes a Christian. And therefore, there is a double-pronged methodology now that you need not go to Dr. Hassan Hathout and try to make him a Christian. He's plus seven. But if you go to him or to his likes, and all you do is to transfer them from plus seven to plus six, that's an achievement. And the plus six to plus five, an achievement. And then perhaps throw some doubts in him, and he becomes plus four, going back to the zero and then being a bear for your evangelization. Also the minuses, you start with them from ambiguity to a little bit of questioning Islam, to a little bit of appreciating Christianity, etc. At minus seven, he is a well-established Christian. We Muslims have always been under the illusion that once a Muslim, ever a Muslim. this is a feeling we take when we live back there. And we think that people change their religions to embrace Islam, but Muslims will never be anything else. Well, please note that while I worked in Kuwait until a few years ago, a doctor friend of mine came to me and he said, "Hassan, my son has become Christian." "Oh, how come?" "I was looking into his desk and I found letters, and he's in contact with people in Monte Carlo, and there is a missionary broadcasting there, and seeing the letters, he became a Christian." Between 1970 and 1982, the number of Christians in Indonesia increased by 12 million, 6 million of whom were through Muslim conversion to Christianity. In this center, there is a family now who lost their son to Christianity. So don't sit complacent and say, "Oh, things will happen." There was a medical student, a girl student in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, who became a Christian, and she was arrested. And they told her, "Either you repent and come back, or we'll be killed." And she repented and came back. I wonder whether it was by her heart. But I will appreciate that many Muslims are very complacent, laissez-faire, things will be all right. And worse than that, many Muslims convey Islam in a way that repels people against Islam. Not only the non-Muslims. I wonder what the Christian world thought when in Afghanistan the girls' school were closed. Who would ever think of becoming a Muslim after that? But I go to a center and I ask the little ones, "Do you like your center?" "I hate it. I hate to come." "Oh, they force me to come. When I grow up, I'll never come again." Why? Imported a sheikh from the Middle East to teach their children, doesn't speak the language. First lesson is, hate the Christians, hate the Shias. What a way to introduce Islam to unsuspecting young people. So when I come to the enemies of Islam, I really wonder. Some are professional enemies whose interests, political and finance, economic, would go against Islam, because Islam calls for justice, and justice is not favored by the unjust, not only individually but country to country, internationally. Others have the heritage of the Crusades still capturing their emotions. Others read about Islam and see in the media things that are very bad about Islam and are no temptation for you to become a Muslim. Others who read Muslims and read Islam in them and realize that Islam is a very bad thing. And we, when I say we, it is not we, you, it is you, who have to shoulder the task of correcting this by reaching out to people. Go to the mosque, attend the lecture to charge your batteries. Why? To use the electricity out there. 5 million Muslims, 250 million Americans. If each Muslim could explain Islam to 50 Americans, then they would have known what Islam really is. And this is on an average, of course. Maybe one of you doesn't speak, etc. I'll go and address 1,000 people for him, etc. But the idea is to feel the urge and the duty the pressing duty that you have to go and tell people what Islam is. Of course, after realizing that they read Islam in you, don't be a crook or a cheat and then go up to preach about Islam. Final thing is that in spite of that sad history amongst Muslims, an Islamic civilization was built upon the basis of Islam. It was not built by the caliphs or by the dictators, but by the file and rank of the nation. When the sciences of language were put, it was not because the caliph said so. When science was pursued, and education, etc., etc., by the momentum of Islam, the Muslim nation could build a civilization. That was a very crucial civilization in the history of the world. And I would just like to enumerate to you some of the achievements of the Muslim civilization. From the point of view of ideology, that humanity is one family, Adam and Eve, single pair of male and female. And therefore, blowing off that myth of racial tensions and the color bars and that kind of thing. That you adore Allah by pondering upon His creation. Don't they see? Don't they think? Don't they reflect? Don't they ponder? You see the mountains, the camels, the fetus in the utero, etc., etc. It was a challenge to the human mind that you come get closer to Allah by understanding His creation. Hence, it is an Islamic rule that one of the Muslim duties is to reveal God's tradition in His creation. استكناء سنة الله في خلقه, which we now give another name called scientific research. And of course, the pursuit of knowledge is a duty upon every Muslim, he or she, etc. A very demarcating thing from what happened in Christian Europe. From early on, the church obstructed scientific progress. And that might have paved the way to the reaction in the other direction. That is, let us banish the church away, and let us banish God away. He is there, we go and visit Him on Sunday, but dare He not come out to tell us what to do. Then the fact that moralities do not live in a legal vacuum. If homosexuality is good, then the law should allow it. If homosexuality is bad, then the law should forbid it. You don't go and teach your child something, and the law of the land drives him in another direction. And so there is that amalgam between the ideological and moral aspect of Islam and the legal aspect of Islam. Physical accomplishment in mathematics, the invention of the science of algebra was an Islamic achievement, the invention of trigonometry, the invention of the zero was an Islamic invention, the use of the Arab numerals, you know, the ones we write 1, 2, 3, 4, before it was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, etc., etc., which made it virtually impossible to do multiplication and division. And therefore the use of the Arab numerals, the science of algorithm, as a matter of fact, algorithm is the name of Al-Khwarizmi. Al-Khwarizmi is a Muslim scientist who invented it and became algorithm. The decimal arithmetic, that you say 5.2, before that the 0.2 that the fraction was not known. In chemistry, the preparation of alcohol, sulfuric acid, nitric acid, aqua regia that dissolves gold. The distillation process was an Islamic invention. The word alkali, alkali, is an Arabic word, actually. In optics, the anatomy and physiology of the eye, as we know it today, started with Al-Hasan ibn al-Haytham. Before that, it was thought that we see things because our eyes send a ray to them, and therefore we see them. The physiology of the eye as receiving an image and comprehending it by the brain was an Islamic thing. The making of the early lenses, the discovery that the white color is a composite of seven colors. And Ibn al-Haytham made his experiment, that is the circle with the seven colors in it, and if you rotate it very fast, what you see is a white color, because it is a composition of those seven colors. In medicine, the development of anesthesia, the development of suturing material out of animal gut. He noticed that when the monkey devoured animal guts and he tried to retrieve it from the stools, he didn't find them. They were digested. And so came the idea of doing suture material for use inside the body so that they become absorbed after that. The surgical instruments of Zahrawi still exists today. The preparation of expensive pharmacopoeia, the discovery of new diseases, the books of Ibn Sina and Ar-Razi were the main components of European universities until the 18th century. The concept of teaching in a university, you know, the chair of chemistry, the chair of surgery, where did it come from? Because in Muslim universities, a sheikh used to sit on a chair, and around him the students would gather. And they would say, the sheikh of Hanafi, the sheikh of Ja'fari, the sheikh of so-and-so. And it has been retained as the chair of. So that usage was taken from the Muslims. Without the Muslims, all the Greek heritage, all the thing you know about Hippocrates and Demosthenes and Platon, etc., would have been missed out altogether from human history. Because it was the hot target of the church to find these and burn them. And it was only through their Arabic translation that later on Europe could know about them. Astronomy, there are 18 sites in the moon and 150 stars and the planets with Arabic names. In geology, the globe as a ball was made, not just flat surfaces. And Idris's maps were the earliest. And I remember I've seen the map of Idrisi, and the world is depicted upside down, so that at the Mediterranean, you would see above Egypt and North and Africa and the rest of Africa, and below you would find Europe, etc. Of course, at the time, the Americans were not known. Even in aviation, in the year 878, Abbas ibn Firnas devised his earliest flying machine. And he took it down from the minaret of the Cordova Mosque and tried to land. It was not successful, of course, but the concept was there. In architecture, in town planning, Cordova, Taj Mahal, etc., etc., the Muslims, one of the popes, went to Spain in order to become a student in a Muslim university. The King of England would send his daughters with a letter of recommendation to become students. People learned Arabic in order to learn medicine and the chemistry and biology, etc., etc., etc. So that was the day that was. Here is the day that is, and where do we take it from here? It is true that we Muslims are backward. It is true that we have no scientific achievements equal to those. Right now, our scientists, Muslim scientists in the United States, are joining the mainstream and doing their duties as scientists, as learned people, etc., etc. But there is another very important aspect. Our current civilization carries within its body the seeds of its own destruction. Because the bird cannot fly in a straight line. One wing is the moral, one wing is the material. The moral wing has atrophied and withered. And therefore the bird flying on one wing can never go in a straight line. And we have the remedy for that. Because the bankruptcy of the current civilization is not economic, is not scientific, but it will be the moral bankruptcy that would cause everything to crumble, as happened to previous civilizations. And nothing can prevent this from happening except providing the missing element. And the missing element is the values, and the values we as Muslims have in the Quran and the teachings of the Prophet. Therefore, we should contribute, we should offer, we should suggest, we should perhaps also convince them that what we offer them is medicine to heal and not poison to kill. And it takes a smiling face so that you wouldn't be hated before you speak, and it takes patience, and it takes love, and it takes reaching out, and it takes becoming a real Muslim. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.